from when we had your shrine, we weren't prevented from going there.
No, we wasn't.
Yeah. Start your day at the Turaway, Northwest London. Tuesday, 24th of Sivan, 13th of June. Rabbi Shlomi Wise, Kashra Shilas from the Archives. This week's Turaway has been sponsored by Family Kirsch, Ilan Ishmael, Subishah, Nochem, Rav Avrom, Goschuk, Zifrin, Rochel. The Ziyad site is on Thursday.
I've probably had more advance notice of giving this year than ever before, and yet I've prepared the least, so I apologise for that. I was working till past midnight last night, and I'll do my best. Okay, so Kashra Shilas from the Archives. In the past I gave a shir called Recent Kashra's Questions, so I thought I'd go Mikotze El Akotze and go back in time and look at some things in the past. One of the reasons for this is that actually I work, my day job is working for the London Basin in the Kashra's department, and it occurred to me some time ago that the London Basin is actually the oldest still functioning basin in the world. Unfortunately, due to the Holocaust and the destruction of Eastern European Jewry and even Western European Jewry, the truth is that there aren't, if you think about it, there aren't many Bote Din that exist more than 200 years. I don't know if there's anyone around more than 200 years.
Didn't the Sephardim have their own Bote Din where they came in, whatever it was? 1650, 1570?
No, neither Ashkenazim nor the Sephardim had a Beis Din for quite a while, because you just had your Chacham or you had the rabbi of the Ashkenazi community. You didn't really have a fixed Beis Din or of any sorts. It's quite well known that the Chacham Tzvi came over to England from Holland to arbitrate a very large and very vigorously debated argument on Choshen Mishpat. I think it was the early 1700s. And one of the reasons they brought the Chacham Tzvi over was not just because of his seniority, but also because they didn't have a fixed Beis Din. So they took the Chacham, it's a Zabla. You take one from here, one from there, and you take another rabbi, and Baruch Hashem, his decision was found to be very pleasing to all sides, so he managed to make Shalom.
What was the date then?
This wasn't going to be a show on the Beis Din. This was going to be a show on Halacha. But just to answer your question, the Beis Din, in a formal sense, was probably founded by Rabbi Shlomo Hirsch, which is Solomon Herschel. He was the chief rabbi of the Great Synagogue between 1802 and 1842, when he passed away. He founded, for a long time, there was a push to have more achdus between the Sephardim and Ashkenazim. Unfortunately, ironically, for those who haven't learned the history, what is now seen as prejudice against Sephardim, for a very long time, the Spanish and Portuguese were very prejudiced against the Ashkenazim. There was a whole series of rules that they made that an Ashkenazi woman couldn't marry into to a Sephardi, and if she did, she couldn't come to shul, and they had a place where you could stand until. So they used to call them Tedescos, which is the German name for Ashkenazim. Sorry, for Germans, I think, in Spanish. Anyway, there was some sort of unity brought about in 1804 when they formed the London Board for Shechita. So that's 1804, and around that sort of time, during his tenure, he started to try and formalize the Beis Din. He sent Dayan to Australia because that was an emerging community. Unfortunately, if you know the history, a lot of Jews were sent there. Not necessarily, you could be a poor person, steal a loaf of bread, and you go sent off to Australia. Anyway, that's a whole sugya in itself. So I've run out of already five minutes. So I will try. Streamline this. Yeah. So,
did London have a Beis Din 200 years ago?
Yerushalayim, no.
Didn't have a Beis Din?
No, not a fixed Beis Din. I mean, Rosh Mor Salant is in the mid-1800s. That's already later. Which Beis Din would you mean? The Rabbanot, when he existed after?
All the
Haredis is much later mentioned.
The
I'm not here to debate the historical facts with you. We can do that another time, if you don't mind. If you don't mind, I'm not here to give a history lesson, number one. And number two, if you'd like to debate any of these points or like to have sources, I will gladly provide them later. Please, let me continue with the shir. Thank you very much. So the truth is that there have been many choshuva dayanim on the Beis Din. However, not all of their ksovim were ever published. Probably, for those who know, probably the best known is the Leivari of Dan Grossman, Sekhon Rocha. And there were others. There have been bits and pieces collected, etc. Unfortunately, I don't know if people saw, there was a book that came out a couple of years called The Rabbi's Suitcase, which talked about two of the great dayanim on the Beis Din. I may mention Rabbi Yaakov Reinowitz and Rabbi Chaim Zussman Cohen. And it seems that there's quite a lot of truvas there that have never been still in Ksav Yad, never been published, and also the first Rav Adler as well. And here and there you get gleaning. So, for example, the Tzitz Eliezer has a long truva at the beginning, and then it's Chelik Gimel. One of his volumes, there's a truva of Dain Abramsky on gelatin, which is a very interesting truva, etc., etc. Anyway, so one of the ones that I'll mention a few of the things which I came across in Sfarim and also came across in actually the London Metropolitan Archives. The first one is if you look in Yeridea Simon Pei Beis about Simone Oif Toho, right? The kashrus of birds, finding very simonim for birds. So the Darkei Tshuva has quite a long, a lot to say. And he there refers to a very big machlokas that took place in Eastern Europe, mostly featuring the rabbi from Yas in Romania. There was a family called, I think they were called Toibus, and I think there was actually a Rav in Bnei Brak we knew, Chassidish Rav in Shikun Vav in Bnei Brak, whose name was Toibus. And they came from Galicia, and they were the Rabbonim of Yas for about over 100 years till the Holocaust. And one of them is fairly well known. I've seen his sefer quoted at least quite a lot. It's called Shas Shuras Oiri V'Yishi. His name was Uri Shragafival Tovus. So he was the Rav Yas. He had an older brother in elsewhere in the north of the country, and they have a whole discussion between them. There was this bird, which they refer to as. Have a look over here. So, I mean, if you may recall, some years ago there was a whole discussion about a brekel chicken, and this is a similar idea. They call it the Goretzkia. So I'm not sure what this Goretzkia was, but sorry.
What chicken?
A few years ago there was a whole discussion about a chicken which looks slightly different to the regular chicken that we're used to, called a brekel, and all the various Jewish press went on about this for weeks and had everyone's so there's a similar idea here, and in short there was a discussion about this. There was a Rav Shmuel Heller from Tzfas who was first said to Asa, then he was said to be Matir. There were some differences between this bird was that they found it had feathers by its feet, and its crown or its crop was slightly smaller than usual than they were used to, and also it seemed to, I'm not familiar with all the behaviors of birds, but it seems to have lain on the ground when it went to sleep, and also it had a slightly different voice, had a deeper sort of crow. Anyway, there's a whole back and forth. There's a debate where this bird came from. People said that there were similar birds in Eretz Yisrael. Some people said it came from a place in India. The truth is, if one looks into the history of chickens apparently are mostly from India originally, and they spread through the Middle East. So definitely Chazal would have been familiar with all the various chickens. Some of them are referred to, it's referred to many different names. Anyway, it's interesting, the reason I bring this is because you can look, and it hasn't been republished, but you can find online, Shailas Tshuva Shailas Shalom, Simchah Beis, so he has a whole discussion about this. And the two people he brings At the end of it, he brings a whole, has a whole discussion of the tshuva. Really, it centers around if you find a bird with the simonim of the Gemara, Gemara Chulin Daf Samach Aleph, the three simonim of Tara, right? The feet and the Krokum and Nikolaf, etc. So if you find a bird that we don't see is a bird of prey, it's not Doris, we don't see it being Doris, we don't see it attacking animals, and we see it has these three simonim of Tara, is that enough to...
Oh, the three simonim, sorry.
The three simonim, I've got the one in front of me, but basically has to have a crown, has to have, Krokum and Nikolaf means that there's a part of the stomach, the gizzard, which is used within the, when it digests food, and basically you can scrape that, you can take off the skin with your nail, you don't need a knife to cut it off. Also the feet, a bird of prey has two toes from the back, two in the front, it's because that's the preying, you know, clawing action, whereas this one will only have one from the back and three from the front. Basically, in short, this looked like a chicken, or it looked like a kosher bird, and that was that enough? There is a Rashi. Rashi Shritta seems to imply that that's not enough. You need a Masoiris for birds. There's a whole discussion when it came to the turkey. I think famous people know about the Shlach Kodesh, etc. Tosfos and the Rambam disagree, and he has a whole long tshuva. Pri Chadosh is also quoted in Dagash as well, that they say that's a chumrah. First of all, Rashi didn't come to argue with the Gemara. Rashi's adding a chumrah. And second of all, here they wanted to claim that there was already a Masoiris because there was a very, very similar, if not the same, bird in Eretz Yisrael. So two of the people he brings at the end, I wouldn't have put this one. Lefi Anias Daiti, I don't know, what do I know? But he quotes the Darche Chaim, right? So, you know, Divrei Chaim, apologies. I'm not enough coffee today. Divrei Chaim, and then Rav Nosson Adler from England. Why those two particular Rabbonim were those who they wrote to? I mean, there definitely were more people involved. There's the Shoyle Meshiv, etc. But it's very interesting that those are the two letters which he brings down in his Sefer. So it seems that refers to him as the Rav. He's actually writing it to the Orev Yishi in his response. Another question that came up, maybe a little bit more, shall we say, more relevant, two shilas that are brought. First of all, there's a tshuva in the Avnei Nezer. It's actually in Choshen Mishpat. I think maybe because, even though it's a kashrus question, it's to do with Eidus. So the Avnei Nezer has a tshuva to the son of Rav Nosson Adler, this Rav Nosson Adler being from London, who was Herman Adler, Rabbi Herman Adler. He's actually referred to by his Yiddish name Naftali. So I actually asked around what the story was with this product, because I couldn't find any information on it, but it's written in Tofresh Nun. This is if anyone wants, it's Avnei Nezer Choshen Mishpat Siman Mem. So the short tshuva to him, in short, what was happening was that the it seems Rabbi Naftali Adler was giving a heksha to something from coconuts. It's not clear what it was. He refers to it as lectin. Now, it's not lectin, it's not lecithin. So none of those things come from coconut. There was a factory that was opened up in London, in West Ham, around that sort of time, called Loders. Loders still exists today. They're actually a very big global company that deals with fats. And some of them are kosher. They have hakshirim even today. So it could be it was a sort of a coconut stearine. Anyway, he writes to him that there were some socherim in Varsha. There were some people wanted to bring this over, and they wanted the heksha of the Avnei Nezer. So, again, the background here isn't clear. There's only what we see in the tshuva, but he says that he saw the tu'uda, he saw the certificate of this of the Rav, of Rav Adler, and he sees that there's listed the Mashkiach from Meshulam Halevi Lewinsky, and he's there in the factory. So he brings down a sugya in Rosh Hashanah. The truth is, our sugya, the Gemara in Chof Beis, the way we have the Girsa, Gemara understands that even for Kiddush HaChodesh, you need to have an Edim who you are familiar with. You know that they're kosher. So the Mishnah there in the second Perek asks, what happens if you're not familiar, you don't know them? So the Gemara has a discussion. You need two Edim to be made that this person is a kosher person. And then the Gemara says that, the Mishnah says that when the Tzedukim by Susim, when they started to cause trouble, so then the Chazal only accepted Edus from people that they knew. It wouldn't be enough because they actually, there's a story in the Gemara that they hired false witnesses to mess up the whole calendar system, and it was caught. But the Ritva has a different Girsa. So the Ritva in his, you know, the Ritva's Girsa was that actually for Edus HaChodesh you only need one aid, right? And he says because it's a Din D'Rabbanon, so that's why he wants to say it's one. But Toch Dvorov, the Ritva says that the din that Eid Echol Neimon Beisurin, that you can rely on one witness, is only when you have a person being made on something. So one person is saying this pizza is kosher, right? It was made in the kosher. So it's one person being made on a chayfet, so or the classic Gemara bringing Tosfos is beginning to get in about the woman who's made on herself that she's tahira, right? To do with nidva. That so it's one person being made on something, but when it comes to being made on people, on the kashrus of people, there that's we don't say eid echod neimon b'isurim, because you're trying to make a chazaka, a cheskus. You're trying to build a cheskus kashrus. If there is a chashad for whatever reason, if you're not sure about this person, you have reason to be suspicious. You need two people, and therefore he writes to Naftali Adler. He says that he would like, he's happy to accept the product, but he wants him to write either with two, either as the Beis Din. So it shouldn't be. I don't know if this was a private hechsher of the chief rabbi at the time, or if it was. But he says as long as if you have two, if the Beis Din of three or two Edim can give Edus on this person, and he's a kosher, then he would be okay. But he can't accept it from one person. So I thought that was an interesting point. I mentioned earlier there was one of the Choshev Dayonim was Reb Chaim Zussman Cohen. Many of the Dayonim, till even later times, came from either Poland, Russia, Lithuania, and this was the case here. Reb Chaim Zussman Cohen first went to live in Manchester. He was a Rav there for a number of years, and then he joined his Shver. Basically replaced his Shver, Rabbi Yaakov Reinowitz, on the Beis Din. So he, there's a sefer which not many people today use, but when I was in the Meir Yeshiva, I noticed that there's a very Choshev HaKolel Ner Gavriel, and they have a whole group going Be'iyun Halacha, and it's called Dor HaMalaktim. I don't know if anyone's familiar, but they quote a sefer called Dal Se Tshuva. And the Dal Se Tshuva is similar to Shari Tshuva, Darkei Tshuva, etc. And it's a collection of various Tshuvas, and it's on Shechita, Treifus, and Nisvaheta. And they bring there an interesting question in Simon Pei Tes. So he brings this, apparently it was a friend of his, I think he was in Piccoli, in northern Litter, and he writes a number of times Reb Chaim Zussman Cohen is mentioned. So he has a question about waiting 6 hours on between meat and milk. And he says he wrote to his friend, Hagaivid Manchester, Bermudinus, England, or Kaes, London. So he has a whole discussion. What's the discussion? A person ate meat, and he keeps, let's just for argument's sake, he keeps 6 hours. He waits 6 hours. Now he's forgotten, is it 6 hours? Maybe it's 5 hours, maybe it's, he's lost track of the time. So what's the din? Can he be mekel? Can he now go and eat milk? So, on the one hand, you might say it's a svek sveka. Number one, it's a suffolk whether he's waited 6 hours. And you're telling me, he didn't wait 6 hours. Well, there are opinions that are more mekel than 6 hours, or 3 hours, 1 hour, whatever. So, can he be mekel? That's one side. On the other side, it's what we would call a dovah sheyesh lematirin, which means that, well, inevitably, if you wait another hour or however long it is, you'll definitely be okay. So usually with the Dovah Sheyesh L'Matirin, we're machmir. We say, why eat something that the classical understanding of the Oshishim material is, why eat something which might be an Issa when you can wait and automatically it'll be definitely Heta? So this is the question. He just says it, Agav, he says it very short in one line. He says, Lakama poiskim lo mahani svek svek b'dov Oshishim material. Which is, this is, right, sometimes a double doubt is not enough to remove you from this Dov Sheishim HaTirin. Dov Sheishim HaTirin has certain stringencies. And Svek Sveka, even though that's quite a reason to be lenient, a double doubt, but wouldn't be. This is really a big sugya. There's a Ramah. Anyone who wants to look it up, it's Yerodei Kuf Yud, Simen Kuf Yud Sif Ches. And then there's also a Ramah in Erchaim Tov Tzadik Zayin Sif Dalet. And the Taz asks a stira in the Ramah on this point about whether a Svek Sveka is Mata Dov Sheishim HaTirin or not. And the Shach gives an answer, the Prichodesh gives an answer, etc. You can have a look there. But this is the discussion. So he wants to give an answer that you can be Mekel. And the reason, his reasoning is interesting, and it has certain Nafka Minas, and he says that the thing that you're losing out here is the time. It's not the food. In other words, the fact is the food will remain the same either way. The milky coffee that you may want to have or whatever it is remain the same, but the time is lacking, and the time you won't get back, and that time is a hefsid. He wants to say that time will never, maybe explain it a little bit clearer, that time will never become mutter. The food, in essence, or the person, will become mutter, but the time that you're waiting won't ever come back. It's not a time that becomes mutter automatically. And he wants to answer with this a couple of points. He actually, well, one of them is, he wants to bring a smach, is a tzlach, a in Psochim, which I won't have time to discuss. But basically, he talks about Svek Sveka with chometz, and he wants to say that although chometz is dovah sheishim atirin, one is allowed to be nene from the chometz. Okay, maybe I should realize the time. I've got a few minutes left. Another, you can have one. I can look there in Psachim Daf Tes. There's a drush v'chiddush from Kivega. He also wants to answer, which is to do with the first, right at the beginning of the Gemara, about Kohenim eating truma at night. And Tosus has a svara to say that maybe you can eat it. The sofik of the Gemara is, are you allowed from Shkia or from Tzeis? And then again, the Rav Kivega asks a question, well, what about Dov Sheishim HaTirin? Should be Osir, because just wait from Shkia to Tzeis, and then you've got no Shailas. So the Rav Kivega wants to answer that we don't say that by it depends whether it's a Sofik in Metzias or Sofik in Din. And he wants to give an answer to say, look, the time between Shkia and Tzeis, you'll never get back. You don't apply Svek Sveka, Dov Sheishim HaTirin to a time period that you're not going to ever get back, and it's never going to come mutter. In other words, if you're going to be machmir, then that time is always going to be considered osa, in which case, when one has a svek svek, can be makel. Maybe I'll have time for one more, very briefly. Okay, I can't go into it in detail, but there were a couple of questions that came about in the Second World War. Dr. Schoenfeld had quite a time with his shver, Rav Hertz. He actually, there is a Darkei Tshuva, I was looking for this, there was a big discussion in Europe amongst many G'day Achronim about something called chicory. And there was a discussion that maybe it had some pig's fat mixed in. And it was quite, even today there are sort of non... Chicory is a coffee type, it's like a substitute for coffee, and people still use it today. And there was a discussion whether they mixed in some pig's fat into that. So as I say, there were machmirim not to have the chicory, etc. So when Dr. Schoen during the war wanted to have his own coffee run. Now during the war, First World War, Second World War, any sort of production was very very strictly governed, and you couldn't just open your own business, and you couldn't just produce whatever you wanted to produce. You had to get permission. So he wanted to do his own coffee run because he felt that the kashrus of the coffee here may not be up to scratch. He was turned down by the government, so he didn't get his way on that occasion. So instead, there was some correspondence with the Beis Din. The Beis Din did what they do very often now, which was they contacted a whole range of coffee makers. It was very interesting to see how many, there's maybe 15 that I saw, and there may be more. You know, if you go to your coffee shop, if you go to a supermarket now, there are not that many brands of coffee drink. There's a few major manufacturers. Of course, there are supermarket ones. If anyone drinks those, I feel sorry for you. but other than that, properly, you know, established brands, that there aren't many. Anyway, in those days, there were many. And also, it seems that, I don't know if this was during, because of the war or it was standard practice, the coffee drink didn't have to be pure coffee. In other words, a bit like your hot chocolate today, you'll have your cocoa, you'll have cocoa butter, you might have vanillin, you'll have lecithin, you might have sugar mixed in, you'll have various things, components. It's a blend. So the coffee drink was also often a blend. Anyway, Baruch Hashem, they found that for the most part, there were many of them just had pure coffee. Some did have chicory, but the chicory didn't have any fat in. There was one manufacturer, whose name escapes me now, but there was one manufacturer who actually did use a small amount of vegetable glycerin in their coffee. It was vegetable glycerin as opposed to animal fat, but nevertheless, and therefore that was that. I didn't see anything further in that debate. Another question came about, which is much more complex, which was that the British government noted that most of the wheat that was coming into the country was from Northern America, North America, Canada. So, unfortunately, U-boats were sinking a lot of ships, and the grain wasn't coming in. They were quickly running out of wheat. So they made laws to up the percentage of wheat used. They basically wanted wholemeal bread as opposed to white bread, and this caused an uproar. People were calling, they made something called the National Loaf, and people used to call it Hitler's secret weapon. They made sure that it was not sliced, and it was only sold one day a week, so it was generally a bit stale, and people, you know, to make people eat less. And anyway, one thing they did was they decided to fortify the flour, which is now the rule in England that all wheat flour must be fortified with certain minerals. And the exception is, as we'll see, is Pesach. And what happened was there was an outcry because it was reported in the papers that there would be milk powder added to the flour at the point of milling. Now, you're a bit stuck, because not only is possibly all your bread on your challah is going to be milchik, but you're also going to have a problem with Pesach, because you've got a tarovus mixed in, and it can make quicken the chometz process. So this, again, was a bit of an uproar. Dr. Schoenfeld, again, wrote to the government about it, the whole thing, but in short, Sof Dover, because I've run out of time, Dan Abramsky and Dan Grunfeld met with the Ministry of Food, and they managed to get some sort of pshara, some sort of compromise, that the rye bread wouldn't have anything added. They could have Pesach flour with no additives. It was a bit special, and that is still to this day. The reason why in this country we can have Pesach flour without any additives is because of this. And they kept the amount of milk powder below Echad B'Shishim. So initially it was possibly a third of a percent. It went up to very close to Echad B'Shishim. And Dan Abramsky writes a tshuva after the war to Rav Herzog in 1951. I'm not sure why Rav Herzog wanted to know what happened, but he writes, and that's how we have... He has a whole din v'cheshbon of is this considered mevatlis in l'chachil or not? It's a whole complex and long sugya that I can't go into. Dr. Schoenfeld wasn't happy with this, neither were the Kehillah and Gateshead. So Dr. Schoenfeld made a little, because he was a smaller community, made an appeal, and the one in Gateshead also did. And then, as you can imagine, when that word got out, other bakers also wanted to, so it kicked off, and the Ministry of Food regretted giving the dispensation to Dr. Schoenfeld, but Baruch Hashem, there was a dispensation as well, and as I say, you could also have rye bread. So those are just some of the shaylos I came across. I'm going to ask you to ask